Williams, and welcome to Conversations with Consequences. We are the radio show and podcast of the Catholic Association, where we aim to change the culture one conversation at a time. You can listen to Conversations with Consequences on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern, or catch the encore at 5 p.m. We are also on Sirius XM channel 130. Of course, our radio show is also a podcast. Go to thecatholicassociation.org or directly to wherever you listen to your podcast. Welcome to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire, and I'm so delighted to be joined by my colleagues at the Catholic Association, Betsy Frenches and Lee Sneed. We are talking today about a television series that you may have seen advertised on your TV or wherever it is that you get your entertainment. It's an interesting new 8-part series about the saints. And it's unusual in that it's produced and directed by Martin Scorsese. So big A-list Hollywood name, not exactly what you think about when you're thinking about the saints. But he has done this new 8-part series, which we've been able to screen. And so, ladies, welcome to the show. And, you know, we've been fortunate to watch some of these episodes. And what are your initial impressions? What did you think of what we were able to see in preview?
I think watching the rest, we've only seen two, Joan of Arc and Maximilian Kolbe. And certainly Scorsese branded beautiful filming, cinematography, you know, costuming quality, all that kind of stuff is there. The episodes aren't very long. And obviously there's lots to say about the lives of the saints and more about them. But I like the docudrama setup of it. I like that there's some narration. Yeah. So I'm still sort of processing it. And I think I would like to think about the series as a whole. So I'm looking forward to the rest of the 6 episodes being released.
Betsy, there's been so many different attempts at capturing, you know, great Catholic stories, and so many of them have flopped. And I think that's because it's a real challenge to accurately capture these complicated figures. Do you think that Scorsese, you know, with what we've seen, does he do a good job of, I guess, just telling their stories accurately?
From what I know, yes. And we all know that there's some problematic parts of him. The Last Temptation of Christ was decried by a lot of people as being sacrilegious. So some of us came to the screen a little bit skeptical of how he would treat these. But adding a little personal history here, I went to Auschwitz 2 years ago, and it was probably the most moving experience of my life in terms of historical place that I've ever been. It was incredibly difficult to be there, and I hadn't thought about that memory at that level except for when I did this screening. And I've never felt the presence of evil more than when I was in that space. And I think the black and white grittiness of this film, and as Lee said, the cinematography is beautiful. It's really the type of quality you would see at a movie theater and not on a television for a show. But I just kind of got those sort of sweaty palms all over again, the way that I felt when I was there. You can't experience the magnitude of it in photographs, just being there. And so I really appreciated the darkness in the evil that he was trying to encapsulate. I was just going to say, and then for Joan of Arc, you know, I've seen the Ingrid Bergman version of that movie, which has sort of, now that we have had people like Spielberg or Scorsese doing movies that try to bring a lot of realism, parts of it seem, you just feel like you're on a Hollywood back lot, you know. But I think they bring different things to the table, those kind of movies, you know, the kind of classic Hollywood one. But I found this Joan of Arc to be very compelling.
You know, I've also been to Auschwitz, and I'm sure, you know, if you did the same tour I did, you actually get to visit the cell where Maximilian Kolbe died.
Yes,
I did. And the episode on Kolbe, as you just described, does this incredibly moving portrayal of
him dying. They're alongside a Jewish prisoner in that very cell. And so I so agree that if you are fortunate to have visited and paid homage at the hallowed grounds of Auschwitz, they really do almost make you feel like you're there. He makes you feel like you're there in the cell with them, kind of dying yourself. And it's almost hard to watch because it's so intense. And that's where, I think Scorsese has done us a gift in that sense of bringing to life, the moment that this man who ultimately became a saint died. Lee, I know a lot of Catholics are talking about the fact that, as we've discussed, that Scorsese is a complicated figure. And so, what do you think as Catholics, how do we navigate that? I mean, and how did you feel watching these episodes with that in mind? Was that something that you were thinking about, or did you kind of leave that? Does that kind of fade away for you? What were your impressions?
Well, I think I went into it with that sort of sense of anticipating being upset, like how we find ourselves, you try to think the best, you're like, I'm going to watch this show, and then something's misinterpreted, or there's some sort of modernist narrative laid on top of a very simple story of, just being, a son or daughter of God, and or a martyr or whatever that is. And I was relieved sort of at every turn. It's almost like, this is a ridiculous comparison, but if you've ever watched My Big Fat Greek Wedding, I'm always so used to things bad happening that whole movie I was sitting on the edge of my chair waiting for something, somebody to break them up or something. And this is the way I felt about, some sort of misrepresentation of what the church believes, or some sort of revisionist sort of, history being told. And even in the panel discussions, which I think you can take or leave. I don't think the series needs them at all, but I think that even there they refrained from trying to reframe things too much, in terms of a modern understanding that, that there's just this faithfulness to the church and the magisterium that exists with these people. And I like too that he drives home the point, I think, and it's true all the time, that people think that saints are these, people on the, stained glass windows in our churches. And just like you said, the scene where in the cell, even that sort of just, that they're stripped of their dignity, their clothes, they're there, they're embracing one another. It is uncomfortable because it's such a reminder of their humanity, our own humanity, our fleshiness. And as Catholics, we really embrace that. And this whole relationship we have with each other as embodied beings. I don't know. I think that it was all of my worries were, for the most part, I think, unfounded. I mean, I think they did a nice job.
Well, it's interesting because I read somewhere that Scorsese said, this is a quote, maybe the fact that there are saints, were saints, and still are saints is something that's lost on our newest generation because we don't live with them. So we thought this was a really good attempt to try and understand what that is and what faith is, really. I think, there's a lot of conjecture, like, oh, does this mean Scorsese is going back to his Catholic roots? And I don't know, Betsy, do you know what his exposure to Catholicism is? I mean, why would someone like him be interested in the saints? I mean, I think he's totally right that there is a fascination and an intrigue with the saints, Catholic or not, but what about his life and upbringing do we know is drawing him to the saints, especially now at this stage in his life?
It's a great question because he grew up in a time in New York City where he was surrounded, I think, particularly by a Catholic Italian, almost ghetto, in the sense that everybody knew everybody. You were defined by your parish. The priest probably walked down the street, talking to the boys as they played stickball, and I think that he is getting sentimental in his old age. There's a quote from the Catholic Standard that might kind of help us understand him. And where he says, I believe in the tenets of Catholicism. I'm not a doctor of the church. I'm not a theologian who could argue the Trinity. But the idea of the resurrection, the idea of the incarnation, the powerful message of compassion and love, that's the key. And then here's a really interesting quote. The sacraments, if you are allowed to take them, to experience them, help you stay close to God. So I always want to believe that somebody is inching closer to what I call the full communion and the fullness of the church and the sacraments. And as Lee so said so well, I was waiting for some kind of whiplash where he did something like, oh no, you had to add that on about your view of Catholicism in the 21st century. But I thought it was very restrained, and it does make you wonder, is this going to be his final opus before he gets too ill to make a movie?
Really interesting. And I love the word restrained there, Betsy, because that's the way I felt too. And what's really interesting in that second quote is that he puts in that caveat, if you're allowed to receive them. That's
Exactly.
a real belief. I mean, that's like a real sign of a belief in the real presence and that the sacraments actually mean something. This isn't just a cultural thing. That, it's an actual religion. And that's, yeah, and also, I mean, this is maybe too much reading into things, but the series did premiere on his birthday.
Oh,
That's so
really?
interesting. His 82nd birthday. Yeah.
Well, I so agree that it suggests a respect for and a reverence for the faith, and that this was not something he was looking to make a quick buck off of. And I do think it's so true. We see this just time and time again that artists and art always often points us to the divine, or that there's an intrigue with the divine. And this is clearly a man who is interested in grappling with the divine. And I think of so many other great films and books that do the same. My personal favorite movie of all time is The Mission. And that was not, I don't think, set out to be a religious evangelization exercise. And yet
Right.
I think it's one of the most powerful and beautiful depictions of conversion and of the actual mission of, the evangelical mission of the church, that, bring it to the ends of the earth, as Pope Francis has called us to do. And I know Scorsese has made another movie, Silence, which I've seen, which was also a very difficult, gritty, violent movie to watch. But Lee and Betsy, I'd be interested in both of your, maybe Lee, you can tell us first, what other movies or even television shows or books have you read that, the author may not have been the model of Catholic piety, but had either depicted the faith well for you, or led you to think kind of deep contemplative Catholic thoughts?
Well, if I can just go back a second, just to what you were talking about with the mission, I think
Yeah.
that the fact that the soundtrack to that is so widely
Mm.
popular still, and that's like part of the genius of cinema, and especially that kind of Scorsese like big production, big that you're carried along. I mean, music is such an evocative, like, feeling thing that you really can get into a story. And sometimes you don't even realize it is the music. But for this movie in particular, I do think there was part of that because it was so popular and so moving. I think that, well, I'll say I haven't finished this book. And so I was thinking of whether or not to say it. So, but the Mark Twain book on Joan of Arc, I'm about halfway through it. And I know that it's not, again, like it's not written by a priest or a theologian, or it's written by Mark Twain, who has his talents, of course, to say the least. But I enjoyed it, and I think anything that I think we're humans and we're imperfect, and I think that beauty can come in lots of different ways, and beauty is something to be open to. I think we have to make sure that we're not being seduced by something that's untrue and appears beautiful. I'm sorry about that. But I think that finding, that I might think the series The Chosen, that's kind of an obvious answer, but it's funny, and I love the depictions of Saint John the Baptist in it, and I love the relationship between the apostles. I think that we can, those are just two examples I can think of off the top of my head. I don't know, what about you, Betsy?
Well, this will come as no surprise to the two of you since we've talked about hospitality, but I think my favorite is Babette's Feast.
Yes, of
And
course.
And there's no Catholic priest, and although Babette is definitely Catholic, I'm pretty sure, because there's something that, and I think she makes the sign of the cross. But this is such a big, larger discussion. I would like to have someone who I heard speak recently at a conference come on the show, talk about the Vatican film list, which we did go through with our kids over a period of years. We didn't watch every movie, but it is interesting what is on that. And sometimes it's one is called The Lavender Hill Mob, and it's with Alec Guinness. And I think it maybe one of his characters in disguise is a priest. But sometimes the Catholic message is very, very oblique. And sometimes it's, like the mission. It's about a missionary or a saint. And I think that sometimes it's really hard to figure out what is it big C Catholic or is it little C Catholic in how a piece of art looks at the world, what are the values or the virtues it's trying to extol, or what are, like from a Thomistic sense, is it just a total absence of good, and by the end of it you feel so drained that you look at it and say, there was nothing redeeming in here, and this is why life without God is really, really bleak. Any other movies? I like John Ford movies. He was a Catholic director. The Searchers is a great movie.
I love The Searchers.
And my husband is a huge film buff. I learned most of this from him. But I also think The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is an incredible movie with Jimmy Stewart and Lee Marvin. I mean, there's so many lessons in that movie. It's long, but I think it's a great movie to have with to show kids too. And while we're on that topic, we've got some nudity in this Kolbe. It's tastefully done because it's, I mean, if you've ever looked at pictures from any concentration camp, the amount of nudity in them is just the reality of what these people faced before they were tragically led to their death. But and then there's something in the Joan of Arc too, where they're trying to test if she is a virgin. And so, again, maybe not for your younger children.
Yeah, no, thank you for pointing that out, Betsy. It's, it's our new fraught world where things, the advertisements themselves on cable news are okay, but there certainly is a lot of mature content. There's violence, there's, as you mentioned, nudity, and it's all done artistically, but it's definitely, this is definitely not a series for children. And thankfully, there's increasingly more great content out there for children about the saints. In fact, my kids love this series called Saint Stories for Kids that are these little short vignettes that we can listen to in the car on the way to school. So there is a lot out there
Where
for
do you
kids.
find those, Ashley? Where do you find those stories?
There's an app, and then I think you can listen to them online too.
Okay.
It did have me thinking that if we were to have Scorsese on our show, the first question I would ask him is, why did he pick the saints that he did? I would find his
Oh,
answer
that's a
on
good
that
one.
to be fascinating. He possibly may have answered that question in interviews that he's done out there. But I am curious to know why he picked those saints. And I mean, certainly Kolbe makes sense because he was a man who was in the world of media, and he's the patron saint of journalists. And he was very ahead of his time in terms of thinking outside the box in terms of how to use media. But I would be curious to know why he picked those saints. And I guess a question that I would have for each of you is, if he had asked you, what saint would you like to see? An episode, maybe he extends the series. What saint would you choose, Betsy?
I think I would choose Catherine of Siena, partly because I don't know as much about her. I've just started the Sigrid Undset biography of her, but I wanted to say one thing about the panel afterwards that bugged me a little bit for the Joan of Arc essay. I'm sorry, the segment was I really like saint stories about strong women, and I think the church has so much to give to the world about how women use their intellect, they use their faith, they use their political, maneuvering, which is what Catherine of Siena did. And I wish that they, for the second panel, I wish that they had had a woman religious talking about Joan of Arc versus Father James Martin. And it's not that I think boys can only talk about boys and girls can talk about girls, but considering this is a progressive panel, it would have been nice for someone, who was ahead of an order or Sisters of Life, and right there in New York City, to talk about how Joan of Arc had inspired them in a religious vocation. So anyway, Catherine of Siena is my vote, and I wish that there had been a woman religious who got to comment.
I so agree, Betsy. And I love what you said about the stories of strong women in the church, and we have so many of them, and they go back, they go so far back. I mean, all this talk about feminism, it's like, whoa, we've been lifting up these icons of intellect and strength and courage, like in the case of Joan of Arc. And I know that if I was consulted by Martin Scorsese, I would have said to Elizabeth Ann Seton. I'm reading her biography
Yeah,
right now,
good
and
one.
what a story of grit. A woman who's was born into a well-off family, and then her husband dies, and she's left penniless with five children. And instead of throwing up her hands, goes on and founds an order and schools all over, and becomes the first American-born person to be made a saint. So that would be me. I don't know, Lee, what about you?
Well, I was my first one was going to be Catherine of Siena, but Betsy beat me to her. But I think that actually now that we're talking more, I'm really glad I came up with my second one choice. It was now my first choice is Saint Gianna, because I think there's so much literature and blogs and essays complaining about the sacrificial nature of motherhood, and this woman, I mean, just embodies what that is, that interdependency, that self-sacrificial love. And I think that having that in, this sort of docuseries thing, and also it wasn't that long ago, and I think it would be more relatable. There's not that mythology like there is around like Saint Joan of Arc or somebody. We can relate to a woman physician, so I think, yeah, Saint Gianna is who I would choose.
Good one.
Well, it's interesting because, we're Catholics, and we're Catholics who take our faith seriously, and this series has caught our attention. And I think a lot of the saints that he chose are ones that are familiar even in homes where that are not Catholic, just because they're great stories. So I don't know, Betsy, do you have thoughts on who is his audience? I mean, maybe his audience is himself, but I don't know. What do you think? Who did he make this for?
I think you're right. I think the first audience is himself, and I think his clock is ticking, and I think he's had a long and storied and complicated and messy career in a personal life. But I find it slightly endearing that this is gnawing at him. Flannery O'Connor talks about the South isn't Christ-centered as Christ-haunted, and I think Scorsese is haunted by his Catholicism. And I'm really hoping that this series is for people who have no clue what a saint is and how canonized and person and all that goes in with that. But also for Catholics who have one foot out of the church that realize that there is a history and a richness and an intercessory nature to a friendship with the saints, especially in this month of November, that can really speak to you sometimes when there's nobody in your life that really understands what you're going through. I mean, there's a saint for everything. There's a saint for cancer. There's a saint for carpenters. There's a saint for what, prostitutes. There's a saint for everybody in every situation.
Well, you mentioned John Ford, and John Wayne, the star of so many John Ford movies, had himself had a deathbed conversion. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to the question I just asked you of who did he make this for, but I think all three of us can hope and pray that conversions do come out of this series, even if the creator of it is himself not fully converted by it, but Certainly, it was an artistic, and I think we all kind of agreed a genuinely a deeply felt attempt to use an artistic gift, not just to bring stories to life, but something deeper and so something worthwhile of our consideration and our thought and our conversation. So with that, I thank you both for joining us today, and what a great time talking about Martin Scorsese's series, The Saints. So thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, Ashley.
Now, Lee, we're also in National Adoption Month, which is a very important time to mark the so many babies and children that need homes. And you not only have your own personal story, but up next, you are talking with Mary Bruno about her own experience with the cross of infertility and the joys of adoption. Can you give us a little snapshot of what your discussion was about?
Absolutely. It was great. Mary has a wonderful new book out. It's a prayer companion to those going through infertility. She's also an adoptive mom like me. We talk about the real lived experience of parenthood through adoption, the joys, the ups and downs, the uncertainties, what I've dubbed maybe babies. You have to stay tuned. I discovered Mary and her work when I was doing research for my own book on infertility out next year from Sophia Institute Press. And in my view, she's written some of the best stuff out there. It's the stuff that I wish that I had had 20 years ago as a young Catholic bride, looking for some real information on this stuff. And I'm so excited that we have finally got her on the show.
Well, we really look forward to hearing your interview, Lee, and make sure to stay tuned right here on EWTN Radio. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Lee Fitzpatrick Sneed, a fellow at the Catholic Association. I'm happy to be with you today as we talk with my friend Mary Bruno, author of several books on infertility, the latest of which is called Holding Space for Joy. November is National Adoption Month. A lot of you already know how I feel about this issue. It's very important to me. I became a mother to my four boys through adoption. Mary and I both have experienced the struggle and hidden gifts that come from infertility, but we're also both moms through adoption. We're so glad she's here with us today. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
Why don't we just start, Mary, with you sharing what you'd like about your own journey to adoption?
Yeah, so adoption is not something I ever saw in my future. Like, I think, like most Catholic women, I grew up very much wanting to be a mom and imagining that happening a very specific way. And I also didn't know anybody else who had adopted. It's not something that my parents really talked about at home. So it felt foreign to me. I had
Sure.
the only experience I had of it was like TV shows where the kid finds out they're adopted. And it's like this horrible thing. I don't know why it was portrayed like that. And also, of course, in my church, I really never heard anything about adoption. So as I grew up, it's not something I ever considered, which I wish I would have, because I think we're all called to discern, God, how are you calling me to bring new life into this world? And that can look so many different ways, we know right
Right,
now.
absolutely.
So I got married to my husband about 12 years ago, and I thought I was diagnosed with endometriosis not long before we got married. Didn't think that would be an issue. It did turn out causing some infertility. And over the years, it was really hard for me to enter into that space of discernment, because I thought moving forward with the adoption process meant that I was saying I can't have biological children.
Sure, I think a lot of women feel that way.
Yeah. So and then it was my worst day ever that really kind of like helped me to think a different way about it. And I started to die to those desires and finally ask God, how do you want to grow our family?
Yeah.
And that's how I started. My husband had experience with adoption with his family. So it's just interesting, I think, to see the two differences there, where he grew up knowing people who were adopted. His parents actually started the process of adoption.
Wow.
And so it wasn't foreign to him. But I was the one that took a while to come on board.
That's funny. My husband and I, we were also young when we experienced infertility. And I can only say, by the grace of God, somehow adopting when we weren't getting, pregnant wasn't, it just I think people had encouraged us, because it can take a long time, to
Yes.
just start, then you'll be ready. You're not obliged to do anything, but this process takes a long time. Just start it. And so we did. And we also had an experience with this was back in the day, Mary, where NAPRO practitioners weren't as easy to be found as they are today. And, to travel to Nebraska and, deal with the limited number of practitioners over the phone, it was tough. And so we had tried to sort of craft our own infertility experience with a secular doctor, and it did not go well. And so I think we were just ready for something else after that. And so we started the process with the home study. And I mean, it's a good thing we were sort of on board with adoption anyway, and realized for us anyway, we felt like we could do both at the same time. Because my plan was to get this started and then start learning Creighton model. But we had a baby within 6 weeks.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, that is unheard of.
I know. And I almost hate to tell that story. But
no, it's okay. Yeah. I mean, that's what God's plan was, obviously.
God's plan, yes. So that was our first one. And then, but I think what we want to talk about too, I think is, I mean, infertility obviously plays a part in both of our adoption stories, because we were infertile and we adopted.
Yeah.
And then we never had biological children. But, just because, just the same way you're not obliged to have a firsthand experience of adoption, to care about it or support it, you're not obliged to adopt a child because you're infertile. And you go to great lengths, I think, to distinguish between those two callings. They're different packages, even though sometimes they walk, they can be best friends. And can we talk about the different kinds of motherhood and the femininity that isn't within all of us, even without a baby?
I love that, because it's something I thought for a while. It's like, here's all your alternatives. Like, you have a biological child, or you adopt. And I think a lot of people who are discerning IVF might consider adoption an alternative. I certainly kind of like thought of it that way for a while, until one day I was writing, actually. I feel like God really speaks to me through my writing. It's kind of a form of prayer for me. And I just realized, like, wait a minute, this is not, we gotta stop thinking about this as an alternative, because adoption is about what's best for the child. And that can look like a lot of different things, but the focus is on the child. And that's where I think the discernment needs to be. It's a discernment for the families who are open to bring new life into their homes in many different ways. And I think that's the key, is that openness.
Absolutely.
Because, and fruitfulness and procreativity, it looks unique for every different family. And so it's okay that it looks differently. Now, IVF is not something we will ever promote or condone. So that's not included in that box. I just want to make that clear. That's a different topic. But no, I just think it's asking God and inviting him into these decisions, whether you're fertile or infertile. Really, it's all about, well, God, how are you calling me to bring new life into my home? Because a lot of, like you're saying, a lot of fertile couples have both biological children and adopted children. So I think it's just getting out of this box that we kind of unintentionally put ourselves in as Catholics, as it has to look a certain way. So I want to like shatter that, because like you mentioned also, motherhood looks so many different ways. We don't have to wait to get married or even have children to activate our motherhood. Like, the world needs our motherhood, our spiritual motherhood, right now, no matter who you are.
I think that's absolutely right. When I was reading your latest book, Holding Space for Joy, and you were talking about this issue, I was thinking of the times that I had a hard time sort of accepting mothering from friends or other people who weren't my actual mother. And I think that that's a real, what a waste, because some women really have a gift of that, and they mother through friendship, and to, especially when you're going through a crisis time, like you're suffering from infertility or something, anything like that. I mean, I just think it's beautiful. And I think about, why did I ever shut myself off to that kind of beautiful love that comes from female friendship? I wanted to ask a little bit about how your discernment sort of changed your views about, like, once you decided to make the plunge, where were you at that journey? Did you know that you weren't going to get pregnant again? Or
no? That's a really good question. I didn't know. We certainly kept trying. I didn't stop with the medical treatments at that time. We continued to pursue it. We certainly wanted to still get pregnant biologically if we could. And so really on that, I talk about it in my first book, 12 Stripes Deep, this worst day ever, where I got a false positive pregnancy test.
Oh yeah.
And so I've never been pregnant. That was the only time it ever had looked like a positive positive. So it really wrecked me because I got angry at God and I was like, look, not only can I not get pregnant, but I can't get the assurance of a negative test to not go on this huge roller coaster ride. Like, it was just horrible. And so that was a day that everything changed because I realized love was a choice, and to choose God, even though I wasn't feeling him, like I wasn't feeling that love. And it was 3 months after that, that I said, I'm ready to say yes to this next step of the adoption process, but I wasn't ready yet to bring a child into my home. Like, my heart wasn't there yet, but I knew that's where God wanted us. So I gave him the trust to say, okay, I'll start this process and you move my heart. And that's what was so beautiful, is giving him that trust, because when we finally adopted Bella almost a year later, he took that whole year to change my heart. And it was just so beautiful and crazy to see, as I look back, how much he changed in me, to where when, even before we welcomed her into our home, like, my heart was fully ready to receive that gift. And it's not something I can explain as a human.
Sure.
That was all God, but that's what he was calling us to do. And I just, so one of the beauties that has come from infertility is really opening my mind and heart again to all the ways God is calling me to be fruitful, not just the ways I want to be fruitful.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's so beautiful, Mary. It's really moving. I found too that we always said it a little bit jokingly, my husband and I, but you know how I think once people know that you're an adoptive parent, if they hear of a baby who might be being placed for adoption or something, they sort of call you about it and like, can you take this baby? And obviously it's much more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. We call them maybe babies because, you know, you never know. There's some crazy stories out there.
Yeah.
We always think of it as it's the infertile's way to be open to life. Mm-hmm. Is to say yes to those children, you know, in just in case they actually wind up in your home. So that was our sort of our version of that being open.
Yeah,
to life.
I love that. Maybe baby.
The maybe baby. Yeah. I mean, honestly, if they had all worked out, I'd have like 27 kids.
Right.
what about your community now? So you said you grew up in a place where they didn't talk much about adoption, but how about now? Have you found an adoption community where you live, or online makes it easier?
Yeah, that's true. And I make sure I'm talking about it. I feel kind of bad when I'm like our adopted daughter, but I'm not saying that to qualify her as like, oh, we didn't have her biologically. I want people to know, like, this is real. We can look like a real family that fits in just like everybody else.
Right.
So I make sure, like, I want to share our experience, and like, it's just beautiful to see how beautifully Bella has been received.
Yeah.
Just like any other kid. I know not everybody has that experience. I've heard from women who have a really hard time in their own families. So I just want to lift them up in prayer and just say, like,
absolutely,
I don't have that experience. We've been very fortunate, but I know it's there. But again, so many people just don't have that around them. And thank God, actually, he did bring into my life a friend who I actually interviewed her about her experience with Napper technology and PCOS. Mm-hmm. And she actually had a failed IUI, and she went through that experience realizing like why the church teaches that this is not a life-giving option.
Right.
And actually found that out on accident. But they adopted not long after we adopted Bella. So that's been really nice community to have. I love for Bella to... I think we need more. There's been a couple, but I would love for her to have some more friends that have experienced adoption as well. So she knows that she's not weird or different. You know, we really want to feel her sadness with her, that,
absolutely,
yeah, our family looks a little bit different and we can feel sad about that, but that's also okay because there's a lot of goodness here too.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. My son, my eldest, when he was little, well, so I'll say this too, if you ever want to give up like the delicious cuisine of Louisiana and the warm weather and want to move north, South Bend is a really great community.
Oh, I bet it is.
Lots of adopted kids up here.
Cool.
And so it was pretty common. It was common enough that my son would be sort of surprised when someone wasn't adopted. I mean, this is like when he was when he was like three. I mean, you know. But then at college this year, he was he's a sophomore, and he was on the welcoming committee, and orientation group. And he went to some, I think, pro-life thing because he's really involved with the Right to Life Club. And he was holding a sign that he always picks, this sign, adoption, the loving option. Mm-hmm. And a freshman came up and said, "Hey, man, I like your sign. I'm adopted too." And now they are like inseparable. And it's so sweet.
I love
and
that.
He has two adopted siblings too. So they're, and no bio siblings. And it's a lot like our house. And he's just a great kid. And it just was so sweet. That one little thing just brought
awesome.
Them together. It is awesome. I just
love
it. Yeah. And I think there's that rare, I have a friend who also has four adopted children also. So Dr. Hilgers doesn't have any biological children. And we talk about the bubble. And I
Oh,
know I've
yes.
talked about the bubble, I think, before on this show. There's things that you can talk about with, fellow adoptive parents that, like you say, it's not, if it's not in your wheelhouse, if it's not something you've thought about or experienced or been close to in any way, it's hard to imagine it, I think.
Yes.
And it's hard to imagine. I think this is probably a lot of pre-adoptive women or women before they adopt feel like they're the bonding thing and all these different things and not
Yes.
seeing your husband in your child's eyes or not seeing yourself and how we know on the other side you do see that.
I was just about to say, it's shocking. You hear of this kind of, but it's like, no, that's not real. But there are several people who have told us how much, and she's a different nationality than we are. She's Guatemala, but still, it is crazy how much our adopted children pick up our facial expressions
It
and our
is
mannerisms,
unbelievable.
and they really do start to resemble you.
Yes.
Isn't that so funny and such a gift from God?
It's incredible. I know I have friends who have five biological children, and the youngest is adopted, and she is of a different race than the rest of them. But I forget she's adopted because she
Yes.
looks exactly like her sisters. Her
For
smile is the
sure.
same, everything, her mannerisms, she speaks the same way. I mean, it's just this,
Yeah.
it's a family, right? It's your family
Right.
vernacular and your same jokes. And I mean, my husband and I always joke that our eldest is more of a Sneed than we are because he's like taken all of like the family ethos and made it his own.
That's
All
cute.
right, let's talk. We have a little bit of time left to talk about this latest book. I love it.
Okay.
It's a prayer companion, something I wish I'd had 20 years ago. I love that you can write in the book. You don't have to have a separate notebook that I would personally lose. And it's just great questions. I love the way you have intentionally ordered the chapters. Why don't you tell me more about the inspiration for writing this book?
Yeah, so 12 Stripes Deep, I kind of call a educational, inspirational memoir. And that really, I think, draws like from that solidarity. Like you said, we are experiencing similar things, but a lot of us don't talk about it. So this is really trying to draw in that community, but also educate as well and inspire and motivate. But this one, the goal is to help women to make the journey their own. So I was shocked to have the grace of God to find acceptance and true joy before I had my medical hysterectomy. So I just wanted to share like how I got there. And so I give nine concepts and then some suggested songs to help you enter in, some original prayers, and then those carefully curated questions to help the reader make that journey of her own, because God is moving some way in you through this time of waiting and suffering, and it's just helping you to uncover that and to find peace, acceptance, and joy of your own.
And your book is such a beautiful reminder of that when it's so easy to forget when you're in the midst of that and you're all about appointments and scheduling and
Yeah.
disappointment and avoiding baby showers and all that stuff that you do. It's so preoccupying.
Right.
It's hard to see the forest through the trees.
Absolutely.
Mary, where can our listeners find you?
So I have a website, marygbruno.com, and I'm on social media at White Lotus Blooming, Instagram
And Mary is very, very good at social media. So I would really recommend following her, especially on Instagram. She does great things. And didn't you serialize, was it this book or another book that you did little mini reels for instead of an audiobook?
Oh,
Like
I did a
by
podcast
chapter by
audio.
chapter?
Yeah, audio pod. I have a podcast audiobook, so it's free. 12 Stripes Deep podcast. You can
Okay.
find anywhere like you listen to podcasts.
That is terrific. All right. Well, thank you all for joining us today. Mary, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. We can't wait to have you back on to talk about more stuff. Maybe we could talk about IVF and all the other fun
Yeah.
stuff, concentrate more on the infertility side of things. I'm just so happy for you and your husband and Bella, and you found each other, and it's just a wonderful story. Okay, so
Thanks, Lee.
to learn more about the TCA team and more about our work and podcast, please visit thecatholicassociation.org.
And now Father Roger Landry offers us a thought-provoking homily to prepare us for this Sunday's gospel.
This is Father Roger Landry. It's a privilege for me to be with you as we enter into the consequential conversation the risen Lord Jesus wants to have with each of us this Sunday as we celebrate him for the 100th time in the Church's liturgical history as King of the Universe. The Solemnity of Christ the King was established by Pope Pius XI in 1925 when he celebrated for the first time on December 31st to conclude the 1925 Jubilee. For the next 44 years, it was celebrated in the traditional Latin liturgy on the last Sunday of October. And since 1970, in the new order of the Mass, it has been celebrated in November on the last Sunday of the liturgical year. This solemnity is an opportunity to celebrate what Christ's kingship means. And then, as Pius XI suggested, to commit ourselves to let him reign in our minds, wills, hearts, and bodies. This Sunday, as we enter into Jesus' dialogue with Pontius Pilate on Good Friday morning, we get a glimpse into the kingdom Christ has established and how it's supposed to impact us. Pilate begins his conversation with Jesus by asking the question that Jews have been discussing and trying to answer about Jesus for the previous 2 years. Are you the king of the Jews? To ask that question was to ask whether Jesus was the long-awaited Messiah. Jesus replied, "Do you say this on your own, or have others told you about me?" Pilate tried to deflect the question, saying, "I'm not a Jew, am I?" But the question can't be ducked, and it can't really be answered by what others have told us. Jesus came into the world to establish a personal, saving relationship with everyone he created. It's the good shepherd who would leave 99 behind and go after the one sheep who was lost. He's interested in all of us. It's not enough for him to be the king of others or even the king of the cosmos. It's not enough for the Pope, the priest, and the catechism to proclaim him sovereign Lord. It doesn't suffice that we dedicate churches to him or whole religious institutes. It's not adequate, in other words, even that the whole church in heaven and on earth acclaims him as the Savior and Lord. Jesus wants each of us personally and intimately to say and mean, "Thy kingdom come," rather than just doing so because others have told us about this reality. Jesus died to become your king and mine, and wants to have that life-giving relationship with each of us. He wants to become the most decisive reality in our life. Therefore, the first response we're called to have is to ask ourselves honestly whether we have that relationship with Jesus. Is he king of our time, of our family and love life, of our work, leisure, and money, of our mind, heart, soul, and strength? Well, he objectively is the one through whom all things are made, the king and lord of all. Have we subjectively, freely, wholeheartedly, and lovingly chosen him to be our king, to obey and follow him with trust, with love, and joy? If we have not yet established him as king of all parts of our life, then we really don't have the relationship with him that's right and just. This is conceptually simple, but morally hard. For us to name Christ as king in this world is not to be a fair-weather fan of Jesus, like those who root for a championship team because they're the winners. By worldly logic, the last thing Jesus looked as he hung upon the cross on Good Friday was as a conquering king. He was bathed in blood, not clothed with royal purple. He was hammered to a cross, not seated on a bejeweled throne. He was crowned with thorns, not capped with gold and diadems. To ridicule him and the Jews in general, Pilate would later order that an inscription in three languages be placed above his head, "Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews." Rather than pay him homage, most in the crowd just mocked him. The chief priests, Roman soldiers, passersby, even the thief on his left mocked him, and they all derided him in the same way. "If you're truly the King of the Jews, the Messiah, the Christ, come down from that cross and save yourself." Such visible force was the only demonstration of kingly power that they could comprehend. To name him as our king is to recalibrate everything to his way of reigning. He told Pilate, "My kingdom doesn't belong to this world and is not here." But we often try to frame his kingdom in earthly categories. All the way until his resurrection, the apostles had a false idea about the kingdom and what it meant to be in the king's service, incessantly competing against each other for the greatest positions in the messianic administration they imagined Jesus was about to inaugurate. But Jesus said to them and to us, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men make their authority over them felt. But it shall not be so among you. Whoever, rather, would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." To proclaim Christ's kingship, to enter his kingdom with him, means to be willing to give our life as a ransom for others, to serve rather than be served, to give rather than get. That's why it's not sufficient to listen to what others are saying about Jesus. We have to proclaim him king ourselves. And this isn't just a notional or verbal consent, but something we live. There's a second point I likewise think is key. After Jesus said he was king of a kingdom not of this world, and Pilate followed up by saying, "Then you are a king," Jesus answered, "You say I'm a king. For this I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to my voice." Once again, Pilate tried to duck the personal thrust of Jesus' words by asking rhetorically, "What is truth?" But we can't escape the meaning of Jesus' words. His whole mission was to remind us of the real, real world and help us live it. Early in the Gospel of St. John, Jesus had said, "If you remain in my word, you will truly be my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Knowing the truth, in other words, is the difference between slavery and freedom, between living a lie and living in the light. little later, Jesus would further specify that the truth isn't a correspondence between what's in our mind and what's in the world only, but it's a personal relationship, telling us during the Last Supper, I am the truth. He came not just to teach us truths, but to allow us to enter into relationship with him as the ground of our whole existence. The big battle in the world, the war between light and darkness, good and evil, life and death, it's ultimately between truth and falsity, between Christ the truth and Satan, whom Jesus calls the liar and the father of lies. To proclaim Christ as king is not just to announce the truth, but to commit ourselves to seek the truth, find the truth, live the truth, love the truth, know the truth and share the truth in a context in which the prince of demons tries to inseminate and seduce us to live a lie. Satan's is a dominion of spin, slander, deception, and self-deception. Christ's kingdom is a kingdom of truth. When Pius XI established the Solemnity of Christ the King in 1925, he did so to counteract the virulent falsehoods being propagated by the communists and militant atheists, proclaiming that God didn't exist, or essentially announcing that truth doesn't exist. Without God and the truth anchoring human existence in reality, they were capable of distorting human anthropology made in God's image and likeness and reordering all existence to their power. Just 8 years before Pius XI instituted the feast, Bolshevik communism had arisen to free the people from the opium of faith in God, which they mendaciously claimed was only a means to keep the people subjugated. In Mexico, there had been a similar revolution against the old order, and one of the first results was anti-clerical persecution based on militant atheism. Religious orders were banned. Churches, monasteries, convents, and other religious buildings were confiscated or burned by the state. The church needed to go underground, and many Catholic priests, religious, and lay people were martyred. Since there really was no God, they claimed, the churches and Christians were just seeking greater foundation for their pursuit of political power. Over the course of the last century, attacks against the truth have grown. For example, in the philosophical movement of relativism, which in a self-contradictory way proclaims as a truth there is no truth, and particularly in moral relativism, which says that it's wrong to believe that there is right and wrong. But now we're facing a particular cultural assault on the truth based on sentimentalism or emotivism. We see it in particular in gender ideology, which many are trying to use to indoctrinate our culture and especially our kids. Gender ideology says that there's no truth to our biology, no truth to our having been made by God as male or female, but that male and female are just social attributions and mental states. We are whoever we want to be, they claim, whoever we say we are. This is not to say that we shouldn't be full of compassion and love for anyone who sincerely, but erroneously, thinks he's a woman trapped in a man's body or a man trapped in a woman's, or someone who's pangender or genderqueer or one of scores of other so-called gender identities. But we all know such people need help and they deserve our love. But we do them no service to pretend with them that they're not male or female, that there's no meaning to that biological truth, that the emperor is well-dressed and living sanely in the real world. We in fact facilitate their living a lie about themselves and make all of society complicit in living that lie. Christ the King came to testify to the truth and says that those who belong to the truth listen to his voice, who in the beginning created us male and female. The Solemnity of Christ the King, which we mark for the 100th time this year, is the occasion for us to reaffirm not just the fact of his kingdom, but to commit ourselves to living the truth in every way and helping others to live it in the context of powerfully ensconced untruths that will injure people in this world and beyond. This Sunday, as we publicly celebrate Christ, the King of the universe, and together cry out, Thy kingdom come, let us commit ourselves to make him king of all parts of our life, to live in the truth of his kingdom, which, as we'll pray in the preface on the Solemnity, is a kingdom of holiness and grace, a kingdom of justice, love, and peace, and to help all others come to recognize, enter, remain in, and extend that kingdom. Long live Christ the King.
Thank you, Father Roger Landry. Make sure to catch all of his great work at catholicpreaching.com, or you can follow his writings at the National Catholic Register. Go to ncregister.com. And until next time, we wish you all the very best, and you go with our prayers.